And hello, welcome back to the show here, and sorry for the delay there getting back in. I was tied up doing something else here. All right, anyway, welcome back to the show, hour two. Greetings to our ground affiliates who are tuning in and sharing the show with us. I was looking at some emails coming in from listeners during the break here. Don't you feel that there is an acceleration going on in those who are currently overtaking the country, in fact, who have already done so, and it will lead to revolution? And I mean their complete coming out as revolution, or are returning to our Constitution and the rule of laws, irrespective of race, religion, creed, or other things used to separate one man from another to benefit who place themselves at the top. I think it's obvious we're heading toward a crisis of some kind. And, you know, it is entirely possible that we're being maneuvered to transform this nation into something new. And this kind of gets back to what I was saying before we went to the news break, that the two problems with the bailout, the first one is that it fundamentally changes the economic nature of the United States of America. When this country started out, it was basically a free market economy. Everybody could work and build businesses. And one of the things that made America great in its very early history is we were operating free of an overburden of nobility that simply presumed that everything that we did belonged to them by some mechanism or other. That was the whole point of the American Revolution, was to get rid of this hereditary rulership class that owned everything, supposedly, to whom our allegiance and our money was constantly to be delivered. And no matter how hard we worked, we could not advance ourselves because we were not of the nobility. And we kicked all that out. And then we had a nation where anybody who wanted to work hard could become prosperous. George Washington owned a distillery. Ben Franklin was into publishing and inventing all kinds of really cool things. John Hancock sold insurance. Paul Revere was a silversmith. And they worked hard, they made their own products, and they were allowed to keep the wealth from their own work. That was the essence of American enterprise back then. And along with that, of course, went the idea that when you took your chance, when you started a business, you could fail. Because that's what freedom really means. It means the freedom to be successful. It means the freedom to fall flat on your face, the freedom to be very, very alone in your failures. And that breeds personal responsibility. With the passage of the bailout bill, our fundamental economic system has been changed. And it's been changed to that of a fascist model. And before I get into that, let me explain by looking at the Soviet Union, which was a communist model. And their theory of operation was that all profits and all losses were socialized, so that money that came in was spent on everybody. When things went bad and there were losses, everybody had to chip in to cover it all. That's the essence of communism. In fascism, the model is that profits are privatized. If your company is doing well, you're allowed to keep the money from that. But if you go into losses, that is socialized. Now, the theory behind that, going back to Benito Mussolini, was that enterprise, businesses, corporations needed to feel that they could take chances and grow and develop new products and new services and new businesses without the fear of going totally broke in the process. So that was the rationale for this kind of model of economy, where if you had a successful business, you got to keep the money from it. But if you went bust, basically the nation as a whole would pick up the tab. And that is where we are with this bailout model. Profits are privatized. These CEOs are still making multi-million dollar packages and their stock portfolios and everything, but losses are now socialized, and that is a fascist model. Now, the other issue about the bailout, and I touched on this yesterday, and I want to mention it again for the benefit of our weekend audience that doesn't tune into the weekday show. The worst thing about this whole bailout that I can see right now is the message that it sends to young people in this country. Because one of the things we as the older generation like to imagine that we can do is inspire the young people to go out, study hard, learn skills, invent new things, become entrepreneurs, become basically the leaders of the future society that we hope our country is turning into. We want them to feel that there's some point to studying hard and growing and learning new skills. And we have just taken that away from them Because what this bailout has sent as a message to everybody in the United States, and the young people are looking at it very carefully, is we've just sent a message that it doesn't matter how hard you work or what you earn. The government can come and take it away at any time if they can just come up with an excuse why it's necessary. And it's going to be very, very difficult to get the young people to be excited about building careers and advanced education and starting new businesses if the far end of a lifetime of work and achievement is it all gets taken away and given to the people who've already got so much money they can't even remember how many homes they live in or how many homes they have scattered around the country like McCain does. And I think this bailout, yeah, it's really good for Wall Street and it's really bad for the American people, but what it's worst of for is literally the future generation of this country. We may see a whole new lost generation. And if you don't know what I mean about that, it's the generation of people who survived World War I. And they'd had this horrible experience that everything they'd ever built, everything they'd ever worked for, was gone in an instant. And they dropped out. They became the beatniks. In the 60s, they were the hippies. We're going to see that all over again. We're going to have a generation of kids who just say, I'm just going to do the bare minimum to get by. Why should I work hard if the government's just going to take it away from me arbitrarily down the road? And they're going to drop out, and frankly, I can't blame them. You know, it's how are you going to stand up in front of a classroom of young kids and say, study hard, work hard, make yourself better? Because what are you going to tell them they're going to get for it? You know, if you're lucky, the government may let you keep a little bit of what you've earned in your entire lifetime. That's going to be a really, really hard sell. Now, getting back to some of the other news here, a couple of things I wanted to cover just basically in this last few minutes here. Everyone's talking about taxes and not paying taxes and so forth and so on. A couple of interesting items have surfaced regarding John McCain and Sarah Palin. Now, as you know from this last week, Sarah Palin has come under fire because she apparently collected some $17,000 in per diem claims against the state of Alaska for days when she stayed in her own personal home as opposed to the governor's mansion. Now, there's an issue about whether she was really entitled to that. But the problem is that because she was staying in her own home, these per diem fees of $17,000 don't represent pass-through expenses from hotels and restaurants. It's income. And it was not declared as such on her income taxes, so she may owe taxes and penalties on that money. Now, hard on the heels of that, examination of Senator John McCain's tax returns are showing no mention at all about gambling. Now, we know that McCain loves to gamble. He goes to the casinos all the time. He's very much connected with the gambling industry. And he gambles a lot. He's seen gambling all the time. And the point is, the way the tax laws are set up, you can't just gamble a bunch of money, take your winnings, subtract your losing, or your losses, and if there's nothing left, you don't declare it. It doesn't work that way. Gambling winnings have to be declared on your income taxes. And then, if you're keeping track of your losses, you will subtract them only up to the amount of your winnings in a different part of the tax form. And McCain did not do that. So already we have a case of, the elites of our society are playing by a different set of tax rules than the rest of us. And, again, it just calls into question the integrity of the entire platform that the GOP is running this year. Anyway, that brings us to the end of this segment. We're going to take a break here and keep looking at the headlines. If you'd like to join us on the air, the number is 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We will be back after these words from our sponsors.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
Americans who own guns, people like you and me, prevent over 1 million violent crimes every year. Get the facts on gun control. Visit armedandsecure.org. That's armedandsecure.org.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. Obviously, the economy continues to be a major, major focus of the news and, indeed, of the political campaign right now. Yesterday, we reported a story to you on how this 90-year-old woman in Akron, Ohio, shot herself, attempting to commit suicide just as sheriff's deputies were trying to evict her from her foreclosed home. And obviously, this kind of an image does not make the nation look very good. And we are hearing this morning that Fannie Mae, which took over the mortgage on her house and had started the eviction proceedings, has now called the eviction off and forgiven the debt. And if she does not die in the hospital from her self-inflicted wounds, they're going to basically let her go back and live out her life in her home. And, you know, I don't want to encourage people out there to go start shooting themselves to try and get out of their mortgage, because I think really it's only going to work the first time. But it does sort of underscore the fact that public image is very important still to these financial institutions, especially with all the anger and hostility of the bailout. So if you are in contention with such an entity, you need to think about, what can I do to publicize the iniquity of the deal or the unfairness of what has happened? And you need to get that out there, and you need to make it public, and I'll tell you why. Because we are still hearing now that the blame for this economic mess is falling on all those irresponsible Americans who bought larger homes they couldn't afford or big screen TVs they couldn't afford, and they just were going wild with the credit cards without any responsibility. And that, of course, is complete nonsense. At the time these people bought the homes, including this 90-year-old woman, at the time they refinanced them even, at the time they bought the big screen TV or the new car, they could afford it. 99% of Americans who were making these deals and buying things on credit looked at their finances and said, yeah, we can afford it right now. And then the high-paying jobs in our country started to disappear, courtesy of the U.S. government, which gave huge tax credits to corporations to ship those jobs overseas. And that's when Americans who were in debt got into trouble. It isn't that they borrowed too much, it's that they had a reasonable expectation that they were going to continue making the money they were already making. Especially because we were always hearing these pronouncements about how wonderful the economy was and everything was going up in price and, you know, all the rest of it. And all of a sudden, the only thing not going up in price are wages and salaries. They're going down. People making $75,000 a year, all of a sudden they're making $35,000 a year. And no wonder they got into trouble. And that's another reason why this bailout, which had no protection for homeowners, worth mentioning, was an insult. It was a bailout of the bankers and investment companies and all on the backs of the American working class. And you know something? In taking $700 billion away from the American people, it's going to make it that much harder for us to be making payments. You know, let me give you a clue about what's going on with the mindset in Washington, D.C. One of the provisions they put in this bailout bill is they raised the maximum insurable deposit limit on savings accounts from $100,000 to $250,000. Now, how many people listening to this broadcast have got $100,000 in a savings account? Not too many, I would suspect. And so for them to put this provision in the bill and think that it's an inducement to support it reveals that our Congress really doesn't understand just how bad things are out here in real working street or working class Main Street America. We don't have $100,000 in a savings account. It doesn't matter to us how high you raise that maximum insurable limit. It doesn't affect us. You know, they're just glibly talking about adding another $7,000 to every taxpayer's chit. We don't have it. We, the people, don't have it. We have been taxed already to the edge of collapse. One out of every five households is already in trouble with the IRS trying to get caught up. And Congress just blithely says, oh, we'll go back and get money. That's their solution to everything. And you know something? Here's a point to think about before we get back to the phones. The Federal Reserve had already pumped about $600 billion in liquidity into the financial system to keep it from collapsing. Now they're doing another $700 billion from us into the system, plus $150 billion in pork barrel to make it more palatable to the politicians who voted it through. What happens when credit swap defaults go bad? Are they going to ask for a bailout? What happens, you know, we've already got the auto industry asking for a bailout. Everybody's solution right now is a bailout. From whom? From the taxpayer. Right now, the American taxpayer is being viewed by our government as this bottomless well of money that they can go on dipping into and dipping into and dipping into anytime they need to fix the problems or patch over the problems with the economy. And I say that patch over because even the bailout bill's strongest supporters admit it doesn't change the fundamentals about the way the economy got into this mess. It's basically, from the point of view of the banks and mortgage houses, it's a reset button on their giant open-air Nintendo set they have that they call Wall Street. They hit the reset button, all the bad investments they made vanish magically, get dumped on the taxpayer, they get all their money back so they can play again. They can start the game over. It's not going to work because the playing environment, meaning us, is different. We're far more skeptical of all these promises about easy credit. And we know our own limits. We're not making as much money as we used to. We can't borrow the money we used to. We won't let ourselves borrow the money that we used to. So the game isn't going to play the same way it did before, which means it's going to wind up being worse. We're going to go back to the phones. Clarence in Oklahoma is calling back in apparently with a postscript. Clarence, what's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind right now, Mike, is the fact that, well, for one thing, we haven't heard from Tom from Sweden.
Yeah, we haven't, actually.
And the other thing is, I'll tell you just real quickly, because I know we're coming up on the break and you'll need to go on the other side here. You know, I'm Cherokee, and I'm a voting member of the Cherokee Nation here in Oklahoma. Look, when you look at it and you have that kind of perspective through my ancestors telling me, now, part of them, you know, part of them were all European, but part of them were Cherokee. But when I look at the whole perspective, this is what they did. The Cherokees, the government has done this stuff. It even did it back 150-plus years ago. They ran them out of their homelands in Tennessee, Georgia, all the places where their homelands were, because they had found some gold there, white prospectors.
Mm-hmm.
So they run the Cherokees to, they said, okay, and they run them to Oklahoma. That's why I'm from Oklahoma.
Yeah, the Trail of Tears.
Yes. They run them to there, and that was done under the auspices of the United States government.
Okay, Clarence, we got a hold there. Stick with us until the other side of the break. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Fear and hate will rule them, send the demon to the road. In shackles we will bind them, to the terror they'll be shown. As mindless slaves they will not think, blind eyes they will not see. They'll jail themselves and call the bars Homeland Security.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. And Clarence, by goodness, ask and ye shall receive. We have Thomas from Sweden on the line. Aloha, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Mr. Rivera. Good morning, Clarence. Thank you. I really feel appreciated, Clarence.
I really appreciate talking to you because, you know, we have to exchange either emails or something here and off the air or something. But I'll tell you. And this is what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you this. And what's happening right now, there is an allegory to it, or in our past history, in the 1830s. And that's when the Cherokee Nation lived in Georgia, Tennessee, you know, North Carolina. That was their area. But then the Europeans moved in, and they found gold. They didn't want the Indians there because they basically they said, we have rights to the land. We've lived here for, you know, umpteen hundreds of years, you know. And what they did was they got laws passed by the U.S. Congress. And not that, but not just the Congress, but actually basically it was the local states that kicked them out. And they said, okay, there's gold, and the Indians don't need it, but the Europeans do, so we're going to move you. And then, but that was in cahoots with the federal government, and the federal government said, okay, we'll send troops down there, and we will force march them. They put them first in, you want to talk about FEMA camps? They first took them and put them, they ran them out of their homes, put them in forts, army forts. And held them until the movement was done. Now they tried to fight it, but they didn't fight it like I would like to have fought it if I would have been there. But their chief, John Ross, was a lawyer. He'd been through Harvard Law or some big law school, and he fought this thing rather than fight a revolution. They decided they'd fight it in the courts. And he went to the Supreme Court. And I mean, he went to the courts and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court held that the government was in violation of the Constitution and it was not lawful to remove my tribe. Andrew Jackson was the president at the time. Andrew Jackson claimed to be a friend of the Indians, but no, when it came down to it, he wasn't. He said, the Supreme Court's made their decision, let them enforce it. At that point, he should have been impeached, because he had just violated his oath of office to make sure that all decisions of the federal government should be obeyed. And then they put my people on the Trail of Tears. And they forced marched them through the winter. And a quarter of them, one-fourth of them, died. That's why it's called the Trail of Tears. And I think we're seeing a modern-day version of this, and that's all I
Well, we definitely are. It's a repeat of history, and not to the same extent, but if you look at the history of Hawaii, which is where I'm sitting at the moment.
And I understand that. I've seen the deals on that, how that happened.
Yeah, the United States government repeatedly broke its own laws and international treaties in its quest to acquire the unsinkable battleship Hawaii. So anyway, we're going to let you two go because we got to cover a couple of other things here before the end of the show today.
Okay.
But
well,
thank you very
is there
much
any way
for...
I can talk to him offline, or can we still be tied up?
I don't know. That's up to Ethan. Okay, Ethan's going to hook you two together. All right. So we're going to let them go talk offline and get their email and everything set aside. All right. I wanted to cover a couple of stories. This one is going out to the family of all of our young men and women in uniform that are serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're getting this story from Stars and Stripes magazine, Military doctors are seeing a resurgence of a rare and sometimes fatal type of pneumonia that is striking young troops who started smoking while deployed downrange. And they're saying three-fourths of those troops came down with the illness while serving in Iraq. Now, the spin of the article is, oh, it's because they're smoking, and it's strange that this seems to be aggravated worse than they would be getting smoking back in the United States, and they're throwing their hands up in amazement, and they don't know what's going on, blah, 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 blah. It's kind of the same runaround we got for Gulf War syndrome. What is going on was actually found 5 years ago by Dr. Pat Doyle, who said the problem is it's a combination of the smoking, which coats the lungs with this very sticky tar, and breathing depleted uranium dust from these armor-penetrating weapons that they are using on the battlefield. And the problem with the depleted uranium is, when it's still in its metallic form, as a munition, it's reasonably safe to handle. But when it is deployed, when it is used, it vaporizes. And the problem is that that vapor of depleted uranium oxidizes. It forms a very fine dust. And anytime the wind blows and picks it up, especially during the dust storm season, it's in the air. It's in suspension. People breathe it in. And if their lungs are coated with this tar from smoking, the dust has a greater tendency to remain in the lungs rather than to be exhaled. Now, we know the depleted uranium that the U.S. has been using in the Middle East is a major problem. They are already detecting the airborne isotopes of it up in Europe and even in London, England. And I would suspect probably by now anybody collecting dust samples and using a mass spectrometer on the eastern seaboard of the United States might be able to detect it. So, once again, we're getting the indication that our young men and women are being exposed to radioactive materials by our own government, which is attempting to basically deny the responsibility for the medical problems they're going to be suffering from this stuff down the road. Because these kids are going to come home with leukemia and lung cancer and all these other illnesses. They're going to spend the rest of their life just withering away in one of the most painful deaths imaginable. And the U.S. government's attitude is, well, that's war. Bad things happen. You know, it's not our problem. The early days of nuclear testing in Nevada, above ground testing, there was a nuclear test that was done where they literally took a bunch of soldiers, they gave them sunglasses to protect them from the atomic bomb, and marched them right into the aftermath of a nuclear explosion to determine how easily ground troops could exploit a breach in enemy lines opened up with a nuclear weapon. And everybody, all those ground troops involved in that test, came down with cancers, leukemia, terrible, devastating, debilitating diseases, and the U.S. government responded by Congress passing a law saying, it's not our problem. We're not responsible. You were a soldier. These kind of things happen when you're a soldier, and that's just the end of it. And now we're seeing a repeat of that all over again. And so if you are military back from Iraq, if you're the family of military recently back from Iraq, if they're suffering any kind of strange respiratory symptoms, get them tested. The problem with the depleted uranium is it is primarily an alpha emitter, which means you can't detect the radioactivity from outside the body. It's got to be done with an endotracheal bronchoscopy and take a sample of the coating of the lungs. And it takes a special kind of radiation meter to detect alpha wave radiation. Most radiation detectors detect beta and gamma radiation just fine, but unless they've got a mica window into the detector tube that will pass the alpha particles, most commercial over-the-counter radiation detectors won't detect alpha radiation. But your body picks it up. It is very toxic material, and this appears to be the real cause of Gulf War syndrome. And what a terrible thing to do to the troops who put on that uniform and go fight the wars. Even if it's a war for conquest and profit, these kids don't deserve that kind of future. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with the last segment of today's show after these words from our sponsors.
Are you tired of searching for Freak Talk Radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the last segment of today's show. And thanks to all the callers that have been calling in and just making it kind of an interesting time for all of us. And again, thanks to Ethan for twiddling the dials and feeding the giant mutant hamster we have in that little wire wheel hooked to the generator that runs all of this stuff. Looking at the mailbox, got an email from a listener. Excuse my ignorance, but isn't there some way to get the governments of the 50 states to remove from office all members of the federal government that voted for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, the Patriot Act, and this latest travesty of justice, $700 billion bailout? In point of fact, if three-quarters of the states were to adopt legislative resolutions calling for the dissolution of the federal government, technically under the law, it is supposed to happen because the way this was country was set up, the states were to retain ultimately all the power. Back when I started the What Really Happened website 15 years ago, there was actually a resolution that was making the rounds of various state legislatures called the Ultimatum Resolution. And it simply said that when the federal debt goes over $6 trillion, the federal government is hereby dissolved. They were not able to get a sufficient number of states to pass this legislation, mostly because everybody working in state government, by and large, they have ambitions to move on to the federal government, which has a much larger trough to feed at. And so, you know, where the states really lost their power was when senators became elected officials, because up until that point, the people were electing their own representatives to the House of Representatives, but the senators were appointed by the governor of the state, and that gave the governor quite a bit more influence in terms of determining the future course of the nation. Then they changed the rules to make senators elected officials, and that basically rendered the state governments somewhat impotent. So most state governments, as Sarah Palin has demonstrated, they aspire to higher office, and they're not going to do anything that to really rock the boat, as it were. Although, obviously, there are very very much alive secessionist movements in quite a number of states right now, including Alaska. Amazingly enough, Sarah Palin was a supporter of the Alaska secession movement early in her career. She has since changed her mind after seeing, you know, just what kind of goodies and perks come along with signing onto the federal government. We have several secessionist movements here in Hawaii. And again, under the exact literal interpretation of U.S. law, Hawaii is not legally a state. But we can't seem to convince the federals to pull their troops out of here and go home. Same thing in Texas. There are secession movements still in California. And a variety of other states. A lot of people are saying, you know, we have a legal right to secede. And they do. Unfortunately, as the Civil War demonstrated, the federal government thinks they have a right to come in and force you to rejoin the Union under force of arms. And they won that last argument. Now, I want to close up today's show. I've been getting a lot of email from people. As I said before, there's so much anger out there. And I don't blame them. I get email from people saying, I'm angry, I don't know what to do. Time will solve that mystery, I'm sure. I get a lot of email from people saying, this makes me so sad, and my advice is, don't be sad, be angry. Anger is going to work for you a lot better than being sad. Sad means you've given up. Anger means you feel like you can fix it. Anger conquers fear. And right now, what the U.S. government wants you to be is afraid to stand up and say, no, that's my $700 billion, and you get your mitts off of it. So anger is definitely a lot better than sadness. But I also get a lot of emails criticizing me for making remarks about tarring and feathering and various other things. And, you know, they're coming back saying, well, you don't really want to pour tar and feathers all over Sarah Palin, do you? And no, I don't really, not personally. Jell-O maybe, but that's a topic for another website entirely. But I use tar and feathers as a metaphor because it is something that was regularly done by the American patriots against the British tax collectors and enforcers of various British law back at a time when, once again, we had a King George in charge of this country who was taking our money to spend on foreign wars and basically ignoring what the American people needed. done with that money. And we're in exactly the same situation again. I mean, Senator Feinstein got up on television and admitted 90% of the people calling her office were opposed to the bailout, but she still voted for it. That means that the senators and the representatives of the Congress are not representing the will of the people. That's the without representation part. They've just added $700 billion to our collective tax bill. That is taxation. So it doesn't matter how you put it together. We have taxation without representation. And in the public school I went to in New Hampshire all those years ago, taxation without representation was considered a just cause to kick out King George. Either one of them. So I personally don't like the idea of violence because it's bad for tourism. It's rough on the landscaping. But I see us heading toward a crisis where I think there's going to be some violence. And obviously so does the government, or they wouldn't be pulling these troops back from Iraq and stationing them in the streets of America, supposedly with non-lethal weapons. But we just found out from NORTHCOM that in point of fact, all of these military units that are in our streets in defiance of posse comitatus, I might add, they have real lethal guns and tanks within easy reach at all times. So we have troops in the streets of America by the government to scare us into not objecting as we get financially raped. And that's a good word for it. So that's what's going on. I think we're going to see a period of violence in the not very distant future because our government is incapable of changing course. They are so totally under the control of the financial interests of this country that they can't change course. Let's face it. Goldman Sachs, which has been the head of the plunge protection team and is going to make out like a bandit on this $700 billion bailout. Let's see. They gave $691,000 to Barack Obama, $468,000 to Hillary Clinton, $229,000 to Mitt Romney, $208,000 to John McCain, $114,000 to Jim Hines, $111,000 to Rudolph Giuliani, $105,000 to Christopher Dodd, $66,000 to John Edwards, and so on and so on and so on and so on and so on. All these people who were getting up on TV this last week and saying, we got to have the bailout, we got to have the bailout, we got to have the bailout. They're personally pocketing hundreds of thousands of dollars from the very Wall Street institutions that are going to be the beneficiaries of this bailout. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I don't have a price. It's probably a lot higher than most of the Congress critters out there. But the bottom line is, these people are not saying what they really believe. They're saying what they're hired to say. They are paid spokesmen and women for the financial industries. And the American people know it now. We have watched this last week as the media hard-sold this bailout plan onto us. And the American people are smart enough to realize it is a complete repeat of the SNL swindle that our president's father pulled back in the 1980s. Same exact methodology. Take all the restraints off the financial industry. The insiders make a huge amount of money very quickly. The losses get dumped on the American people. Same exact game plan. President Bush is probably celebrating that he succeeded in outdoing his father. Ego involved in this thing. And I think somewhere down the road, there's going to be an incident that will trigger a violent reaction among the American people. I know the U.S. government is getting ready to deal with it. I'm hoping it'll be as fast and relatively blood-free as the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is, I think, where the United States is heading. Or it may be as fast as the Romanian Revolution. I mean, 2 weeks before it all came apart, looking across Romania, if you weren't aware of what was going on inside the country, you would have said everything's fine here. They're perfectly okay with TV cameras looking down at every street corner at them. They're okay with the government reading their mail and listening to their phone calls without warrants. They're perfectly all right with all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, just a spark hit the people. A sporting event turned into a spontaneous political rally, and 2 weeks later, Ceausescu was dead on national television. I'd pay for that pay-per-view, by the way. This brings us to the end of our show today. We'll be back Monday with more of your phone calls, more news. I don't know. I got a bad feeling about next week. I think it's going to be a real rocky time, because if the economy continues to go down despite the bailout, it's going to be obvious to everybody we were sold the world's biggest, most expensive lemon by the U.S. Congress and the media. So until Monday, stay safe, be well, hug your loved ones, and aloha, America.